The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Margaret Kimberly has been an editor and senior columnist of Black Agenda Report since its inception in 2006. Her work has also appeared on sites such as Alternet and Counterpunch, and in publications such as the Dallas Morning News and the Chicago Defender. She is a regular guest on radio talk shows and has appeared on Al Jazeera English, Russia Today, and the Real News Network. And this week she's on Zero Squared to discuss the aftermath of the Parisian attacks. During the podcast, I asked why Russia can't be or doesn't want to be a member of NATO. There is, as per usual, a specific historical answer to that question, but neither of us raised it. Specifically, while a partnership with Russia and NATO was established after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, NATO decided to suspend cooperation with Russia in response to the conflict in the Ukraine in 2014. Relations between NATO and Russia have been strained since the Georgian conflict in 2008. What it comes down to is a series of conflicts over how far the European Union should extend and which nations should join the Union. This much is obvious, really, but it bears being said directly here at the outset. It's Wednesday, December 2nd, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear a clip from the Mizzou student protests, Negative Land's hit song Guns, and Colin Powell's comments on the conflict between Russia and Georgia. The music you're listening to right now is from Negative Land's 1980 album titled What Else? Negative Land. But in just a moment, you'll hear Margaret Kimberly and I discuss imperialism or security. So how have you been?
I'm pretty good. Good.
I'm glad to get you back onto the podcast and talk to you again.
Yeah.
Whenever I get you onto the podcast, it means things are going badly, Margaret.
Really?
I think so. In the world, I mean.
Ah. I was like, am I jinxing the world?
No, it's not your fault. It's like when stuff goes badly, you know, I want to talk to you. You're paying attention in ways I sometimes am not. So I'm always glad to turn to you to get some help.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm glad I can. Like, I appreciate people who give me new ways of thinking about things. So that's quite a compliment. Thank you.
Yeah. So, okay. So what we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about the Paris, the attacks in Paris, mm-hmm. the shooting down of an airplane by Turkey. A Russian plane was shot down. And ISIS, I guess, will have to be part of that conversation.
Sure.
And then I guess what the left is going to do. Well, maybe we can save that to the end.
Sure.
Let me just ask you this first. How serious is the possibility of a military conflict between the United States and Russia right now?
Well, I feel like it's fairly serious risk. You know, I think so many things have happened in history that nobody intended. I doubt that the president of Turkey gave an order to shoot down a Russian plane. Yet Turkey did shoot down a Russian plane and kill one of the crew, and one of those trying to rescue also died. And that's very, very serious. even if no one intended for it to happen, or somebody else intended for it to happen. So here you have, it's eerily reminiscent of World War I and how that began, it seems to me. We even have Serbs, you know, taking sides with Russia, and I was like, oh my God, this is... sounds like a bad history lesson, but what we have is 20 years of the United States encroaching upon Russia's sphere of influence. When first Bush was president and the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a verbal agreement between Gorbachev and Bush that the United States would not try to push the boundaries of NATO. And little by little, over the past 20 years, mostly during the Clinton presidency, many Eastern European nations that were members of the Eastern Bloc joined NATO. So you have, and this of course concerns Russia, and that's quite understandable to me, anyway, why Russia would not want this to be the case. I don't know why we need NATO. I mean, once the Soviet Union collapsed, what did we need NATO for? But at any rate, it's of course, it has gone on and on, and NATO now is just the arm of U.S. imperialism. So when they want regime change in Libya or regime change in Syria or to try to intimidate the Russians, then suddenly NATO reappears. So this has been going on for quite a long time. The Ukraine, when the U.S. was behind a coup against the president of Ukraine in early 2014. Ukraine is literally right next to Russia. It was always the path to invasions of Russia. And of course, Putin reacted, annexed the Crimea, which, by the way, most Crimeans wanted and had in some form or other been requesting over the years, but that's not the information we were given here. It was just Putin's a pariah, Putin's a monster, Putin's like Hitler. So, and then we have Syria, who is a friend of Russia. And finally, since 2011, and the attempt by the U.S. and NATO to overthrow Assad, President Assad of Syria, Putin finally sends troops. The one outpost, the one military base that Russians have outside of their country is in Syria. And so this is very serious now that Putin drew this line in the sand, which I think is perfectly reasonable, but we now have a system in the world where the U.S. has been used to getting its way.
Well, see, here's what I don't quite understand is what is at stake between Russia and the United States. When the United States puts bases near France, the French don't feel that we're encroaching on them, right? Because they're NATO nations. You know, they're
right,
NATO
allies.
Members, right. So they're strong allies. What is the opposition between Russia and the United States today? There's not the ideological difference that there used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So is it economic interest? Why can't Russia join NATO? I mean, that's maybe a naive question. But, I mean, why is this a struggle?
Well, why would they want to? I mean, the struggle is for the United States not to essentially control the whole world, and for there to be a as some say, a multipolar world. Instead of having one superpower, I think the Russians want to be their own superpower, so they certainly would assert their own interests, and to say that they, in fact, have interests that are different from the United States, and they can make friends with countries that the United States calls enemies, so they have no need to want to be have that kind of relationship.
Right, but that's what I don't quite understand. Not that we should be in charge, but what is the divide? But why is it easier for us to ally with some countries, some of them which are quite independent and powerful nations, and more difficult for us to form a real alliance with Russia? What's at stake? What are we really disagreeing about with Russia? What are we competing for?
I think we're competing for spheres of influence. Russia has its own and wants to have its own. There are countries in the world that the U.S. has, you know, made enemies of. There's no reason for Iran to be an enemy of the United States. But they want to have a friend in the world, and Russia wants to be independent and to act in its own interest and act in its own right. And they can't do that and be under American influence. So when there are countries that want to go their own way, who are vilified by the United States, and it could be Venezuela, you know, it could be Cuba, and it could be Iran, they are looking for a powerful friend. And Russia wants to be that powerful friend and wants to be a respected superpower, too, and recognized as a country that can also set the agenda, an agenda that can be different from the United States. They want to be independent of us.
Okay. I think I'm just stuck in the Cold War in my thinking. So, like, I really understand clearly that the Soviet Union, which had a completely different approach to structuring their society and their economy, definitely was at odds with, you know, mm-hmm. disagreed with the Western capitalism. Mm-hmm. Russia doesn't. There's no ideological differences that I can see between.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. I think when the Soviet, and I'm not an expert on the Soviet Union or Russia, but I think that there's still people in Russia who are, they're not officially a communist party anymore, but I still think they have that ideology to some degree. And yes, there are capitalists in Russia and people who got very wealthy during the Yeltsin years. But I think there is still an appeal for that system among many people there. And so I think there is still an ideological difference between the two poles. So I don't think the Soviet Union, you know, as an entity collapsed, but I don't think that ideology disappeared altogether.
Except for General Powell, it basically hopes that Russia is not going to be the aggressor. And if Russia is, and you have to, keep your NATO allies' security, aren't you then committed?
Under Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, which is the NATO treaty, when one member of the alliance is attacked from abroad, meaning outside the NATO geographic limits, then all members of NATO treat that as an attack.
And yet,
Article 5 has only been invoked once in the history of the alliance, and that was on the 12th of September, 2001, when it was invoked in our favor, when the whole NATO alliance said we were attacked. The alliance was attacked on 9/11. Now, in the current situation, the Russians acted brutally. I think they acted foolishly, but it was also absolutely predictable what the Russians would do. You could see them stacking up their troops, and I think it was foolhardy on the part of President Saakashvili and the Georgian government to kick over this can, to light a match in a room full of gas fumes.
So you're saying the Georgians provoked this?
They did. I mean, there was a lot of reasons to have provocations in the area, but the match that started the conflagration was from the Georgian side.
And debate in the presidential elections have basically been, we are all Georgians now. What does that mean?
It's one
the same
candidate
said
that, and I'll let the candidate explain it for himself.
You can help a little if you'd like.
No, the fact of the matter is that you have to be very careful in a situation like this, not just to leap to one side or the other until you've taken a good analysis of the whole situation. This was something that might have been avoided if people had looked at the Russian troops that were stacked up, if people had realized that the Russians were serious about South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and if perhaps more guidance and suggestions had been given to President Saakashvili beyond those that he received, it might have been avoided. But it wasn't. It's over. The Russians are the offenders right now, and we have to see that. We cannot say to the Russians, we are not going to allow the Georgians or Ukrainians or anyone else to start down the path toward NATO membership. It's not for the Russians to decide that. But I think it is wise for us to look at the whole strategic situation and all of our equities before deciding how fast that should happen and whether it's the time to do it right now. Russian Federation is not going to become the Soviet Union again. That movie failed at the box office. But they do have interest, and we have to think carefully about their interest. So you have to treat Russia as a proud country that lost a lot of its pride some 15, 16 years ago, and it's restored with a political leadership that is enormously popular in the country and with a level of wealth they've never had before and with concerns about their near abroad, and treat them in a straightforward, business-like, objective way and not emotionally.
If one thing that's of interest to me is because I'm working with the British press as I'm looking at what's going on in the UK right now, and of everyone I've heard who's a political leader speak since the Paris attacks, the person who's made the most sense to me is Jeremy Corbyn, the minority leader in the UK. But what I noticed was that Cameron and Corbyn have something in common, which they're not emphasizing, which is they both of them would like to see whatever kind of military action takes place against ISIS include the Russians. Corbyn is much more direct about what is needed than Cameron. Cameron would like to pretend that Russia will just be included in attacks on ISIS, but that whatever conflicts there are around Assad and Syria will just be swept under the rug. Corbyn wants to settle, the civil war, come to some sort of accord. And I think what it will mean is allowing Assad to continue to rule and giving up this idea of regime change. I think Corbyn isn't saying that, but I think that's what he'd like. I don't think Cameron is that far off from that position either.
Well, they're not that far off anymore because Putin changed everything. When he went from verbalizing support for Assad to militarily supporting Assad. So that was the game changer. And so now the reality has changed. So even if people want to keep saying Assad must go, that's just not true anymore. That's just old news. And people who like President Obama who keep saying that just sound foolish. Putin's calling the shots in Syria now. So Cameron, I think, has been forced by circumstance to say that we're going to have to work out something with Assad and maybe he can stay because everything's changed. So he has to.
Yeah, no, but neither side want to take their eyes off of ISIS and go down this really horrible path towards outright military conflict between Russia and the Western powers, which, and NATO, I guess. And no one wants to see that happen.
I don't think so. I don't think anybody does. But the thing that always scares me is, as I mentioned before, the inadvertent incident, something that nobody wants, but, end up getting anyway, just miscalculation. I'm always afraid of just the arrogance of the West after Libya, after the U.S. and NATO assassinated Gaddafi, destroyed that country. It is now among the worst failed states on the planet. But in 2011, they got rid of Gaddafi in less than a year. And I think flush with that victory, they assumed it would be as easy to get rid of Assad. They did not see him being able to hang on for four more years. Had they been able to foresee that, they might have acted differently. But, they were kind of stuck in this decision that they had made.
They underestimated Russia's commitment to Assad.
They underestimated Assad and Russia's commitment. So, for example, with Libya, the Russians were duped into abstaining in the Security Council when the West wanted a no-fly zone over Libya, which, Libya was the only one with planes, so that meant Libya, so they could bomb more easily and get rid of Gaddafi faster. So having had that experience, the Russians numerous times over the past 4 years have said, do you think we're stupid? Of course we're going to veto any no-fly zone resolutions that you may want to put before the Security Council. So they underestimated Russia's resolve, yes, and also Syria's strength.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Syria, to describe Syria as strong right now seems
After 4 years, they're weak, but I don't think they thought they could get rid of Assad. In fact, a few months ago, a story came to light. The U.S. media have been selective in reporting it or not, but a Finnish diplomat named Matti Ahtisaari, I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, former Nobel Peace Prize winner, he revealed that a few years ago the Russians came to him and said they were willing to deal over Assad. They were willing to throw Assad under a bus, and that was in, I think, 2012. But the U.S. said, no, he's about to fall, so we don't have to make any deals. So in the U.S. arrogance, they turned down an opportunity to maybe get some of what they wanted, because they wanted everything. They want another Libya situation. So, but had they known that in 2015, Assad would still have, while weakened, still have an army in the field, they might have chosen differently. So Assad has been stronger than anybody thought. And I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing for the world that he could resist. It would not be a good thing if a group of countries can just decide, we want somebody out and we're going to put somebody in and not have to pay a price for it. That's not good at all.
Okay, so you've described Libya as a failed state.
Mm-hmm.
What is the United States getting out of that?
Well, that's not what they thought was going to happen. I think they they just misread this. You know, sometimes we think these people are very smart and know what the hell they're doing, and sometimes they're just pretty damn stupid and don't know what they're doing. And I think they picked a side to win. But when the other thing nobody wants to own up to now, in Libya, the U.S. backed jihadists to overthrow Gaddafi. But there was one group they thought was, you know, this guy was going to be the prime minister. But he was overthrown by the people who still had the weapons they were given by the West. And that's what happened in Benghazi. America's ambassador was killed by some of the people the U.S. had been backing, because they will take arms and money from the U.S., but ultimately they do what they want to do. And that's been the story of the U.S. with jihadists for the past 40 years. So things did not turn out in Libya the way they hoped. But they haven't learned the lesson, and apparently now I think it's such a slippery slope, it's difficult to turn back and to dial things back. And that's why they were using jihadists, ISIS among them, in Syria. And that's why they weren't really bombing ISIS. They hoped ISIS would take out Assad. So there was a lot of lip service about ISIS being evil and we want to get rid of them. But they didn't bomb ISIS. You know, Putin came in, he just dropped bombs. It's like pretty, you know, simple military strategy, which the U.S. and NATO could have done all along. But they hoped ISIS, and they were playing this dangerous game again. You know, ISIS can help get rid of Assad, and then hopefully we can get what we want. And Putin's argument has been all along, it's just another Syria. So, you know, forget about it. You're about to create...
You mean another Libya?
Another mess, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now we have been bombing ISIS, as has France even, for
right.
the last, what, year and a half? Something like that?
Not really. Not that much, no.
No. So, but we have been bombing them some in the last 6 months or something.
The last month or so. And then, of course, you know, Putin showed them all to be liars. And they're like, actually, we are bombing ISIS. Here we go. We're going on a bombing run. So that was that kind of thing.
Oh.
So I'd say since the past 2 months, they've actually been.
So before the terrorist attacks in Paris,
mm-hmm.
there were bombing campaigns from NATO forces.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so Mike, one last question on, you know, the game of risk that's going on here. What is it that, other than not wanting to see another failed state like Libya and not wanting U.S. influence to reach into Syria, what is Russia's relationship with Assad, and what does Syria provide for Russia strategically or materially?
Well, the two countries were always close. As I said, it's the only military base presence that the Russians have outside of their country.
Mm-hmm.
It's the last vestige of the days when the Soviet had influence and had a presence in many places all over the world. So having been shrunk down to talk about a failed state in the 90s, that's all Russia was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suspect they have this long-standing alliance, the desire to be a player in the world,
mm-hmm.
to have a seat at the table, if you will. And they also want the United States to stop. They've drawn a line. So it's a combination of all of those things. And having watched the United States create ISIS with its occupation of Iraq, embolden more jihadists in Libya, they've finally said, this is the line.
To stiffen the will to win, mass propaganda was used for the first time.
This propaganda, they told us about them killing women and children and one thing and another. They had a lot of propaganda about that there. The Hun, you know, they called it.
Well, rocking and rolling on full auto is a lot of fun.
They felt the women had been ignored.
So now we've had another set of terrorist attacks, and
yeah.
This time in Paris. And I feel as though that the emergence of ISIS and this terrorist attack is an indictment of the last 14 years of the war on terror.
Mm-hmm.
That people of any political stripe at this point can, at least you can begin to present a case to people of any political stripe, that the approach we've been taking isn't working. That and rather than terrorism and the influence of radical Islam in the Middle East declining, that it is in fact only getting stronger. We have, in a way, an actual terrorist state now, which is new. I mean, that's just really hasn't, as bad as any of these governments have been, they haven't been terrorist states quite in this way. I mean, they've committed acts of terror, but it's a little different, you know. This is an organization which is, I mean, this is a state that's founded on the principle of suicide bombing, you know, it's and beheading and all of this. Very, very frightening to me ideologically. These guys, ISIS guys, they're almost like out of a maybe this is Western propaganda. I don't think so, though. It seemed like a very deranged approach. I mean, this is one of the reasons why we have the refugee crisis, right?
Oh, well, the United States is entirely to blame for the Syrian refugee crisis. I mean, people used to say, blame America first person. And I'm like, well, yeah, I am, because had the United States not tried to over... There was opposition to Assad. But it was the United and the Saudis, the Gulf monarch states in particular, who want Assad gone. They don't want any strong secular governments to be in existence. And it's this, and many of these people are just mercenaries. Some ISIS, some of the other, you know, so-called, I don't know why they keep trying to call these people moderates, but they have destroyed Syria, and they, the support they have gotten, there are 9 million Syrians who are displaced, some in the country, some out of the country. So, yes, that's responsible for the refugee crisis, which everybody cared about when the refugees started going to Europe. You know, if they were living in refugee camps in Syria or Jordan or Lebanon, nobody cared too much. But then it's like, oh, my God, here they are in Germany. So now it's an issue.
No one wants it in their own backyard, you know. So what was I getting at here? So anyway, what I was getting at was that the approach to terrorism with military intervention and the toppling of states and the occupation of Iraq and the toppling of Gaddafi, all of this has only led to a situation where the Middle East is in crisis, and Syria is in crisis, Iraq is in crisis, and we are more at risk than we were before. So it seems to me that making the case to the American public for more military intervention right now should be difficult. But it isn't very difficult.
No, it isn't, because, you know, Americans don't know very much. I mean, just to people in this country are loath to think that we have any propaganda here. We love to think we have a free press and all that, but we've been propagandized into thinking, believing in American superiority and rightness. The 9/11 attacks, you know, you can learn the wrong lesson from something. And we had to go get them. We had to go nuke them. So, you know, Afghanistan is still occupied, because it never made sense to me that, like, 12 guys who were working from different places in the world, and some of them were from Afghanistan, so we had to try to take over an entire country. It never just made any logical sense to me. But the terror attacks were used as a pretext, as an excuse for to bring back U.S. imperialism. So instead of a war, it was called a war on terror or a war against terror, but it turned into a war of terror against many people in that region. So, but Americans don't know anything else, and anyone who tries to say anything differently is just squashed, does not get any media attention, any political support. Everybody just falls into line. So there's no one to tell people that, no, this is what created this mess. So, no, we do not want any military interventions. I mean, Obama learned some of it when he was a candidate. He famously said, I'm not against all wars, I'm just against dumb wars. And for him, a dumb war meant sending the U.S. military in, the hate phrase that I hate so much, boots on the ground. So, you can get rid of Gaddafi with bombs, and you can try to do the same thing with Assad, and you back somebody else to do the fighting. That's what Americans don't want. Americans don't want U.S. soldiers to be sent in large numbers. So so that's, that's where we are now. So we have a country that's really unprepared to discuss any of these issues, and I find it interesting that all the presidential candidates say essentially the same thing about foreign policy. I mean, there's very little deviation. It's like, well, we should send more troops, or more troops here instead of there, or we got to fight ISIS this way or that way, but there's no willingness to look at the past to say that things were not just didn't work, but were wrong. From a moral point of view, I kept, expecting somebody, at least one of the Republicans, to say about Putin, they all try to outdo each other, saying how much they hate Putin and how much they want to isolate him. And actually, it's the U.S. that's isolated now. But anyway, I keep expecting someone to say, it was Nixon who went to China. you know, or something. But no, it's just the opposite. So we have this terrible conformity about America's role in the world and what we ought to do. So people literally can't think beyond that. They've had nothing presented to them that's different at all. And when you frame things in this us versus them, and what was it Bush used to say there, the evildoers, you're with us or you're against us. And I think that point of view, even now, still predominates among the American public. So they're just evil people to be subdued. There's nothing for us to change. There's nothing for us to admit we did wrong. There's nothing for us to stop doing. It's just you're either for us or you're against us.
One of the things I noticed was that even Bernie Sanders is pretty much falling in line. I mean, he has some disagreements here and there, but he's by and large falling in line with the status quo out of Washington. Mm-hmm. And that you can compare what he is saying to, again, to Jeremy Corbyn, and there's a marked difference between the kind of radical left that you have in Britain and what you have in the United States. Now, yeah. Corbyn is under massive attack.
And, oh, absolutely.
And there are many predicting that he won't last much longer based on this and other ways that he's alienating the British public. But, you know, but nonetheless, he's in as a minority leader, and he has enough of a base to be there, and he is saying what I think is only rational at this point. He's not, mm-hmm. I mean, he's not talking about, but I want to actually approach this with you, because this is one of the reasons I want to talk to you, because I think you and I have a disagreement about one thing, and it's not about what should happen. It's about how we try to have influence as the left. Okay, so after 9/11, I would talk to everyone about this issue of whether or not Osama bin Laden should be deported and put on trial, and what was standing in the way of that, and how the U.S. was not interested in seeing that happen. And that's actually, all of that was just, I think, the facts, at least from everything I've read. If you read deeply enough, you can see that there were avenues open for extradition, and the United States was as responsible as anyone for shutting those avenues down. And I would say, you know, the Taliban's not being unreasonable when they're asking for evidence for extradition. And we as the American public should expect that as well. After all, we just suffered a terrible loss of 3,000 people in New York City. And don't we want to know what the truth is? How do we make allowances for the United States and say they don't have to present evidence? If we don't have evidence, how do we know we're being protected? You know? But often enough, I was heard as being pro-Taliban. You know? And I think that there's a risk at this moment to sort of fall into the hands of the right and being perceived as being, if not pro-ISIS, then pro-Putin in a way that I'm not, and I don't think you are either. I mean, I think that you are siding, based on the facts, on certain issues, just as I was with the Taliban, right? I was saying the Taliban has every right, as bad as they are in every other respect, they are asking for sensible things here, some evidence so they can extradite Osama bin Laden. In fact, they didn't even need evidence in the end. They just wanted to turn him over to an international court or, you know, to a third party, not directly to the United States, which made sense to have some impartial force stepping in. But the reality is that we are on dangerous ground rhetorically at this moment, and we have a really strong case based on the facts. And so I worry that we sometimes, and you know, Facebook is such a bad way to judge what someone's thinking, that we sometimes sound as if we are just the enemy of our enemies is our friend kind of approach. So how do you approach that when you're talking to people or thinking about this issue to make sure that you're kind of grounding this in the interest of American working people? And European working people, and working people in Russia, and people who were really should be trying to build solidarity with.
Yeah, I mean, I try to think of myself as being pro-humanity. That's how I hope I want to be, and you know, and I hope those are the views I end up expressing. And it, you know, it's hard. I used to be, you know, when the invasion of Iraq started, I was an anti-war person, anti-US wars, I think is probably more apt to say. Now I, you know, while I still want change to take place without people being killed, certainly, I now being more anti-imperialist, and I understand the importance of there being countries in the world who can stand up to U.S. imperialism. And, you know, and people, you know, you make reference to it. It's like, you're pro-Putin, you like Putin, you're a Putin apologist. It's like, no, it's just, I think there needs to be somebody to say to the United States who can back it up, you can't come over here. You can't do this again. You can't come over, you know, we're not being dupes again. This is no Libya. No, you're not going to do this again. And I think it's important to have that parity in the world, which keeps the worst instincts of our political leaders in line. Because sometimes that, you know, it's important to have resistance because it can keep, you know, people don't suddenly turn good or turn smart. They just say, oh, we can't get away with this. So I think it's important to have forces who prevent these worst instincts, as I call them. So that's the way I like to think. I mean, it's an interesting time because, you know, it's, and people, I think Americans can tend to couch things in terms of good and bad. It's like, well, Putin's not good. And it's like, well, no, I didn't say he was good. You don't, you know, you see those group photos from the G8 or the G20, you're looking at the least good people on the planet. You know, none of them are good. They don't get to be where they are by being good. So I'm not asserting certain things out of naivete, but I do think it's important sometimes to choose sides, and sometimes an effort to just to stop something from happening. I think it's important for the United States and its allies in NATO and the Gulf Monarch states to know they can't do everything they want to. And so it's important for someone to be able to stop them.
Okay, so this I think is the disagreement between us, and I'm not sure how strong a disagreement it is. I mean, it certainly makes sense to me that, well, just for instance, that during the Cold War, the U.S. was in some ways constrained by the Soviet presence. Also, though, during the Cold War, the U.S. was more motivated to be violent in the world at the same time. There was a limit, and there was a motivation to, you know, just in the present moment, too, with the Russian influence in Syria and someone you're competing with to gain influence, that is a motivation to be more aggressive where you can be, right? But it also means that at a certain point, because you don't want outright conflict with the other imperial power, that, and would you agree that Russia is another imperial power, or, you know, has at least those ambitions?
It may have those ambitions. It's not anymore.
Right. So. It was certainly when it was the Soviet Union an imperial power, and then and it has those ambitions. It's that kind of imperial ambition that's motivating the conflict, even on the Russian side. Would you agree with that? So yeah. On the one hand, we see a conflict between imperial powers checking both sides in their aggression. At the same time, it's motivating the aggression. And I feel as though what we started our conversation with is that the risk right now of a conflict between imperial powers is so great that to pick sides between them is a mistake, and that what we ought to be doing is looking for solidarity between this a third power, which is the power of working people who want to see a different kind of world and trying to find common ground there and going to people and saying, look, not only is this a horrible, not only has the last 14 years been a horror show for the people we've been, you know, our government's been bombing, but it has only made our lives worse and, you know, made us less secure,
yes.
You know, made us less able to cope with domestic issues at home. we need a different approach. And a settled, settlement in Syria, an end to the civil war in Syria, and a united front against ISIS, that is in our interest. That's not just in our interest. It's in the interest of the people of Syria and in who are under ISIS tyranny and in Iraq. That is the best approach right now, rather than saying, Russia, we're glad Russia is checking U.S. imperialism.
Well, I think what the thing that Americans need to learn is that we have to stop U.S. interventions. It is not America's business who runs Syria. The United States doesn't have a right to say that anybody has to go. And that we, our government, that is to say, I don't mean we, but that our government does not have a right to decide who runs Syria. If there are people in Syria who want to get rid of Assad, it's up to them to figure out how to do it. And, well, the United States isn't honest about that anyway, because we never minded backing some fairly horrible people around, and still do around the world. But I think that's the first thing Americans have to politically have to learn. Any time you're told we have to get rid of somebody or send in the troops, the answer needs to be no. We do not have the right to intervene in the affairs of other countries. And when our government does that, it creates humanitarian disaster, death, refugees, potential conflicts with other countries. I think that can be the starting point. And because our government does not have that history, we have created tremendous suffering for many people, and now are in this position of having to decide, who we as individuals should support, and to be at the point where you're happy that another country is dropping bombs, which I don't generally want to be in favor of. So I think that should be the starting point in talking about foreign policy with the average person. We need to be opposed to U.S. interventions. We need to tell our government to stop intervening around the world. I think that's something that makes more sense, and I think you can then say, and because we have not done this, we are now facing this crisis, and this crisis. And our government has created, we wouldn't be talking about Syrian refugees if our government had not felt that it had the right to change a government in Syria. So I think that can be the starting point for talking about foreign policy.
What about this? What about, rather than saying the U.S. should stop all interventions, which sounds like you're saying we should, which can be twisted into saying we shouldn't do anything to protect ourselves from ISIS, which is what was said to me in after.
We have ISIS because of you.
I know, but that's a set.
Now that we have it, you mean?
Yeah, right. I mean, what happened with when I was, protesting against the invasion and bombing of Afghanistan and then Iraq, but really early days when I was saying we need to not bomb Afghanistan, people would say, well, what are we? I mean, we have to do something. We've been attacked. What do we have to protect ourselves? And I would say, eventually, I came to saying something like, well, look, if we want to change what's going on in Afghanistan, we have to start with where we have real influence rather than, we have to find our, change the, what I said was, look, the first thing to do is to go to Israel and come up with a peaceful settlement to the Palestinian issue. If you want to bring stability to us and to that region, there's your first step. And then, that's intervention. It's just not military intervention that's narrowly defined by very narrow U.S. interests. It's in the interests of the U.S. public. And the same things are true, I think, right now in regards to ISIS. You want to stop ISIS? Intervene in Saudi Arabia. Don't overthrow their state, but make demands on Saudi Arabia. Stop the flow of money to ISIS out of Saudi Arabia.
Well, I don't mean that we should be, that our government should be passive, but all the things we talk about that you've just mentioned are undoing the things that should never have happened in the first place. And I think that is the lesson, because I think the issue is self-determination. Every country has the right to self-determination. So the Palestinian people have a right to self-determination. People have, and the greatest right of self-determination is just to stay alive. So the United States doesn't have the right to make some foreign policy decision and kill people or displace them from their homes. So I think that can be the starting point. We, you know, Americans love to talk about, you know, being independent and nobody can mess with us. Well, you know, we should treat other people the same way. Let's not mess with other people either, because we see how many ways that creates so much suffering. So the intervention with, or just don't support. It's like, you know, Israel wouldn't exist without the United States. And when they go on a killing spree in Gaza, they, you know, they always end up asking, can we have more money or can we have more bullets now? So it's, I mean, it's a very direct tie between the United States and that government, which exists for, you know, that's a whole other conversation. But I think the role we have to play is as the non-intervener first. So when the Saudis want to get rid of somebody, say, no, no, we're not. Which is not, and then you don't have to worry about, oh, how do we get rid of ISIS? Well, you know, you went down that, you know, path to hell, that road to hell, when you were evil doing with another country to take away another people's right. So I think that's that, and I think in talking to people, I think you can say, because we didn't do that, now we're trying to undo. Now we're trying to decide to let in refugees. Now we're trying to decide what to tell the Saudis. Now we're trying to decide what to tell Israel. Well, I don't think that they're trying to do that at all. But so then you have a series of difficult decisions to make, because the initial premise is wrong. And I think that's a way to talk to people about how we should stop creating these crises around the world. But I think also, too, you'd have to, you know, and I don't know how ready Americans are to talk about the, you know, the realities, the history of what the country has done in the past. And that's, you know, that's dicey, because, you know, people don't like to acknowledge the wrongs that their country has committed. And but I think you have to go back in the past. I mean, if you want to talk about Afghanistan, you know, we were in propaganda. We were told the Soviets have invaded Afghanistan. Well, the government at the time, a left-wing government in Afghanistan, invited the Soviets in. And our, you know, backing people like bin Laden in the late 70s had created a whole series of catastrophes, one of which struck us on September 11th, 2001. So that is the beginning of, you know, that is how all these messes begin. Someone here deciding to do something to someone somewhere else. And when we keep going down that path, we just get more and more crisis and more chaos. And the way to avoid it is to not go down that path to begin with. When I hear about, I can't remember what the figure was, but there are like 50 so-called moderates in Syria, and we spent, was it $500 million to train 50 people? I mean, it was something bizarre. I mean, an amount of money that could have, you know, accomplished everything from giving everybody health care to, you know, paying teachers to, I mean, you name it, to hiring people here in this country. You could go on and on and on with what the good that could be done with that money. But I, you know, and I also think, you know, eventually you have, when you ask yourself, why do they do this? I think this is what they want to do. I was thinking about when the Soviet Union collapsed. Do you remember there was talk of a peace dividend, you know, that we could cut our military spending because there was no longer a Soviet Union? You know, and that didn't happen. That's not what happened. They said, the Soviet Union fell apart. Let's make more NATO nations. Let's spend more in the military. So I think at a certain point, I mean, you can't hit people with, you know, a million facts at once, but then at a certain point, you have to talk about real systemic change and why our country behaves the way it does around the world, and that's pretty serious stuff. I don't know. I don't know how many people are ready to hear that.
Well, you know,
it's a process. It was for me, so I acknowledge that it is for other people.
I think if you start with what's in your self-interest, what do you want? What does security mean for you? I think that that's a really strong way to start, and especially now, more than it was. I mean, it was really the truth back then, 14 years ago, which, by the way, what the fuck happened 14 years ago? Am I that? I'm 44? This is the, okay, but, but okay, 14 years ago, it made a lot of, it made sense, but now it's, I think, even clearer because 9/11 and the aftermath were on everyone's mind. It was not on the back pages of the newspaper. It was just, everyone was thinking about and looking at this, that we can make a pretty easy, you know, argument to people that don't require, it doesn't require them to go deep into the woods to see that this has been a failure. The other thing I want to ask about here, or just touch on here at the end, is what the left is right now in the United States and in Europe, but in the United States, since we're both here, and how we need to rethink our approaches at this moment, because I just remember how much of a failure the peace movement was after 9/11. And one of the reasons I think it was a failure was because it never had any sincere ambitions to have influence.
Well, that's true. I think the peace movement at that time was more anti-Bush and anti-Republican than anything. And so when we got a Democratic president, it just evaporated. And who was marketed to us as a peace candidate, which Obama was not. Everybody just disappeared. And well, the other thing the left is not is the Democratic Party. That's the other thing that kills the left, and that's the Democrats. And you can see it especially when we're in the midst of electoral politics season, where we are, you know, urged to defy the Republicans at every turn, and I'm certainly can agree with that. But the so-called difference we get isn't much of a difference. Being herded into the Democratic camp again is one of the things that has killed the left. It's why the left is so, the true left is, as I see, is so tiny, because we keep backing the Democrats. So we have Democratic candidates. You know, Bernie Sanders is supposed to be a leftist, which he's not really. And, you know, he was a liberal Democrat, essentially, which, you know, doesn't even mean that much nowadays. Getting into the electoral fray, but backing the Democrats has been deadly for the left. It's just killed us.
The other thing I noticed was even those who I knew who were not going to be swayed and were not going to enter the fray of electoral politics had a position where what they were most concerned about was making it known that they opposed the war and that the state was acting without their permission. Not that they had any ambition to change that the actions of the state, but simply and for me, it's all summed up in the name of an organization, which is not in my name. So we had essentially moral posturing from the left around this issue, and rather than any hopeful desire to stop this from happening, and you know, and I the big story for me was the peace organizations in Portland were planning the protest against the war when the bombs started dropping on Iraq, like 6 months before that happened. You know, before most of the public knew that we were going to go and bomb Iraq, the peace activists were clued in enough to completely see the writing on the wall. And they were just planning on what their position would be in that circumstance, not changing the circumstance. So I feel that the reason that happens, I don't know exactly why that happens. I think part of the reason that happens is because we on the left are not very good at talking to one another and coming to agreements, and we're as fractured as ever.
Well, yeah, I think that's part of the problem. And I think so we have these left movements that are supposedly left movements that aren't very political. And so, you know, so obviously they can't, ultimately they're not going to be able to achieve anything.
Job to do. No, I'm documenting this for a national news.
Yes,
I can. This is the First Amendment that protects your right to stand here, protects mine.
You're not going to yell at her. Just calm down. You're not going to do
it. Okay, ma'am.
She doesn't want you. They don't want you in front of her.
Ma'am, don't yell at me. Ma'am, the First Amendment protects your right to be here and mine.
Okay, we protect you. You protect our space. You're talking to a woman.
There's not a law around that.
Forget a law. How about humanity? Or respect.
Well, how about documenting this for posterity?
Please, sir.
No.
Sir, I am sorry. These are people too. You need to back off.
No, there's no law.
You're not, you know what? Let's back off about personal space. Back off. Leave these students alone. Back off.
Don't push me.
You need to get out.
No, I don't.
You need to get out.
I actually don't.
All right. Hey, you want to help me get this driver out of here? I need your bustle over here. Help me get him out. Who's going to help me?
Are you documenting? What are you
I'm
doing?
I'm documenting.
Okay, well.
You need to get out. You need to get out.
This is public property.
And I know that's a really good one. I'm a communication faculty, and I really get that argument. But you need to go. You need to go.
No, you need to get out. 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 No, you need to get out. 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 No, you need to get out. 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 No, you need to get out. You need to get out. You need to get out. You need to get out.
No, I don't.
You need to get out.
I actually don't.
All right. Hey, you want to help me get this reporter out of here? I need some muscle over here. Help me get him out. Who's going to help me?
Like, let's talk about Black Lives Matter, right? Which is, I think they are, right now, Black Lives Matter is the most prominent and successful left movement in America. Occupy was actually smaller. And this is where the left is at the moment. But it's set up in such a way that it's very difficult to come to common cause with across ethnic groups. It's very difficult to make sense of it politically. Even when it just comes to people who are firmly within Black Lives Matter, they're split on which Democratic candidate to support.
Well, they're the most prominent. I don't know about successful, because my question is, what does success mean for Black Lives Matter? We still have, you know, they came to prominence with, actually they started with the acquittal of Trayvon Martin's killer, and as the police killings became more commonly known, and the degree to which American police are violent. So they are prominent. It's not clear to me, because I've looked at their website, and it's not clear to me what success means to them, because they can be very non-political. They had a conference this summer, and I looked at the website, and it was a lot of touchy-feely stuff about healing spaces and safe spaces, and I'm not against that, but I was like, where's the politics? Should you endorse candidates? I would think that they would not, but they seem to have a desire to want, you know, they're shrewd enough to know it would be a mistake to start endorsing people, but that seems to be their, you know, their the direction they're going to go in. I mean, success to me for Black Lives Matter mean that police killings stop. It would mean that the Obama Justice Department prosecutes some of these cops. That, to me, would be success. So until that happens, I, you know, aside from, and I'm not saying we obviously desperately did need to bring attention to the issue of police violence, but I'm not seeing it from them either. And we live in a country, it's like, you know, if people are successful, but it's damning with faint praise, so the right vilify them. But that doesn't mean that they're really doing anything that the rest of us should be supporting either, because that's, I mean, how hard is it for Fox News to criticize you? That doesn't say very much to me. I mean, it can, but it, you know, doesn't necessarily.
I tell you, it helps sell books.
Well, it sure does. True, true.
Yeah, when I love it when the Fox News takes one of my, you know, the Zero Books authors and says, this is a problem in America. It's like, yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, and I think that's, you know, partly we're laughing, but I think that is true. And that's a danger with, yeah. You know, how we judge and how we determine the successfulness of a group or an individual. So, you know, here we are. We know police killings are a problem. These, you know, videos of police shootings, I don't even look at them anymore. It's like, you know, modern-day snuff films. It's like, I don't think that's necessarily success for people to be able to see yet again someone being killed by the police. So I don't know what success means. You know, if they endorse Hillary Clinton, is Hillary Clinton going to prosecute cops? Are they, you know, really negotiating as a political actor? So I don't know yet. So I'm withholding judgment on Black Lives Matter as an organization, not on the concept.
What I've seen happen, I think we've all seen happen, is that Black Lives Matter has moved onto university campuses. I mean, it's kind of came out of there too, and now the primary demand of Black Lives Matter, as far as I can tell, is for the university administrations, whatever which one it is, to be more influential on policing the behavior of white students. That's to me, that seems to be their primary demand in creating safe spaces where they are not going to be facing racial attack. And certainly no one should be facing physical or any kind of attack on a university campus. So that's not a completely unreasonable demand, but it seems very far away from the kind of demand where you're asking for political power.
Well, that's, you know, and that's my problem with them. You know, a demand of, you know, Black Agenda Report and other groups, the Black Coalition, is for community control of the police, not civilian complaint review boards, but actual control where people around the country would have the right to hire and fire and demand and get the prosecution of police when we need it. That's a big ask. And, you know, I think you can make a demand without knowing exactly how you're going to get it, because I think if you if you wait till you know how things are going to shake out, women still wouldn't have the right to vote, and we'd still have slavery. So I think, sometimes you have to just go out there and say, this is what we want. And it's not clear to me what Black Lives Matter demands are. What are they? So it's we're still in a quandary now. It's an interesting moment where, as usual, historically, the young people are now leading the way and having these actions on college campuses and telling the press, you know, this is not for you, and which is pretty gutsy. I don't think it's bad, because you can't always trust the media. So, I'm going to trust these young people to lead on some of this. But so that's where we are now, where we... You know, we know what issues we need to pay attention to, but the people who are ready to make the demands are not the ones given the prominence.
The other thing is, how do we bring this critique of racism on college campuses, or a critique of the police, into a broader critique of U.S. society, so that there could be a mass movement? I mean, and one which was trying to really be self-determined and look out for its own interests. Just going back to the left, we don't have enough. Not only don't we have enough agreement on between all the little left groupsicles and all that, we don't even have a way of. I mean, this conversation I think was great, because you and I didn't fundamentally agree about a small thing at the beginning, but we found all these points of agreement as we were talking, and it was. I think it was a very fruitful conversation, but I think it's very rare for those kinds of conversations to occur.
Unfortunately, and I think, too, there has to be a wholesale, you know, throwing out of things we believe in. And I'll go back to this. One of the best things the left can do is to ditch the Democratic Party. I'll just give you one reason why. In 2009 and 2010, the Democrats controlled the White House and both houses of Congress and did not raise the minimum wage. And now that it's not possible because Republicans control Congress, they all talk about raising the minimum wage. Well, when they had a chance to do it, they didn't. And I think that's something we have to first at least point out to people, that we could have a higher minimum wage if the Democratic Party had really wanted it. And so here we have to start with very basic things. That should be, for all their talk, that should have been low-hanging fruit for the Democrats. And they didn't lift a finger.
But will we ever be able to get the left to really commit to that without also simultaneously building an alternative left party?
We have to. When I say ditch the Democrats, I'm ready to do it. And I know I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton, who ultimately will be the nominee. The New York primary doesn't matter much because it happens so late. But I'm not going to vote in it because I have made my choice of support for the Green Party. And I think we have to start somewhere. We have to start rebuilding. And we've got to get rid of this phony progressive party that we have that cannot do the simplest things that Democrats used to do. You know, people say they're on the left wing of the Democratic Party. There was a time when that meant something. But now it doesn't mean anything. We have a center-right. The Democrats are a center-right party. We have a far-right party and a center-right party. And in a country where, you know, so the Democrats will sign on to austerity, and the Democrats will sign on to military intervention, and they don't even give you a damn minimum wage increase. So I think they've proven themselves to be pretty much useless, and holding up the, you know, Republican boogeyman of the moment, who in this case is Donald Trump, and saying, see, look how horrible they are, you have to back the Democrats. No, thank you, it does not mean I have to back the Democrats. Not that that's something I want, but we have to stop being afraid. I think we have too much political activity just based on fear. We're just so afraid of the Republicans. So you can't ask the Democrats anything. We have to be glad there's a Democrat in, and so you can't say anything. And that, to me, is just a recipe for failure, which is what we've gotten.